Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When President Biden took office in 2021, one of his first moves was to disband the 1776 Commission, set up by former President Trump as part of the backlash to the New York Times 1619 Project, which revolved American history around the enslavement of Black Americans. Trump said that the truth, quote, taught students to hate their own country, end quote. Ohio State historian Hassan Kwame Jeffries has a different take. Hassan Jeffries is an associate professor of history at Ohio State University, where he teaches courses on the civil rights and Black Power movements. Hassan Kwame Jeffries, welcome back.
And it's great to be with you this one last time.
I wasn't going to miss one last time with Hassan Kwame Jeffries. Listeners, coming up later in the program, glad to hear your questions or your comments. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's just a lot in the news, so let's start off with that, because an Ohio House committee is hearing testimony now on a Senate bill, Senate Bill 83, or actually it's a companion bill in the House, which would ban publicly funded colleges and university staff and faculty from striking. It would require students to take certain American history courses and threaten faculty tenure with quote-unquote bias tests. Yeah. And shorten the term of the Board of Trustees. So the measure would eliminate as well, and maybe more importantly, or I don't even know what's more important, but most diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at Ohio State and all the rest of the publicly funded universities and colleges. Where do you start? I guess let's just start with the diversity, equity, inclusion, because that was really just start, in my opinion, just starting to really get some momentum.
Yeah, real momentum. I mean, Ohio State, of course, has had for a number of decades now the Office of Minority Affairs that sort of came out of the student struggles of the late 60s, early 1970s, that has been doing wonderful work, evolved and changed into, you know, the Office of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion and the like. And so, you know, we've had it on the ground. We've needed it on the ground, engaging with students, engaging with faculty, recruiting students of diverse backgrounds, recruiting faculty of diverse backgrounds, doing the programming that makes everyone feel at home at The Ohio State University, engaging in what Ohio State's motto is, education for citizenship. I mean, there's no better example of educating for citizenship than the work that has been done around diversity, equity, and inclusion here at The Ohio State University. And so to flag that as the problem rather than what it has been, a solution to these broader problems of inequity, is really just tragic, and it's sad, and it's misdirected, but we have to take it seriously. A lot of this, you mentioned, you know, when you open the 1776 commission and all this other silliness, but that what was in that executive order that Donald Trump signed in 2020, in September of 2020, became the blueprint for all of the other quote-unquote divisive issue bills that appeared in state legislatures across the country. It was copycat legislation. Now, Ohio has had its own, but Florida, of course, with Ron DeSantis, has really taken the lead. But Florida is not Las Vegas. What happens in Florida doesn't stay in Florida. It spreads. And what we see now with this latest bill, 83, is copycat legislation attacking tenure, attacking academic freedom, attacking diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. It ain't original to Ohio, but it's here now, and we have to deal with it and make sure it doesn't take effect.
Does it make any difference that it's happening in multiple states at the same time?
It makes a difference in the sense that, you know, it builds momentum. It provides cover for the minority of voices that want to push this particular anti-education, anti-honesty in education agenda. And so, you know, Ohio legislators can say, well, look, you know, this isn't original to us. This is what the people want. No, this isn't what the people want. This is what a handful of folk engaged in politics who are using this to gin up sort of political hysteria to say that somehow children are being led astray. And so it does matter, but I think we have to put into perspective, you know, how wide it is and who is actually supporting this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about American history today with Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's an associate professor of history at OSU, where he teaches courses on the civil rights movement and Black Power movement. He's also host of the Teaching Hard History podcast. We'll have a link to that at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Professor Jeffries, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. I wanted to talk about something kind of nuanced right now, because what the research is telling us is that indeed there is a feeling of discomfort in speaking out in college classes. And I'm just using that very generally. Of course, it depends on what the class is and everything. But they're saying that it's more of a student-to-student issue. Now, I think that's a problem, too. If students don't feel comfortable, is there something, are we dropping the ball somewhere earlier down the road in getting them to talk about these things before they get to college?
Well, certainly. I mean, when we're talking about uncomfortable subjects, difficult subjects, hard histories, then we shouldn't wait until you get to college to begin to create an environment, an atmosphere that allows people to talk about these things. We should be getting very early on. The easiest place to have difficult conversations in terms of K through 12 is in kindergarten, is in first grade, because these youngsters, they'll talk about anything, right? I mean, I'm almost afraid to go into those classrooms. They make me nervous. But then we condition them not to talk about these things, not to have these conversations. And so by the time they reach us, you know, at The Ohio State University, they've been conditioned that this is impolite. These are the questions that you have should not be shared in public. And that's across the spectrum, right? Across the political spectrum. But I will say this, we have to be careful, because we're hearing a lot of this from the political right, saying that, you know, these classrooms are, you know, are breeding grounds for leftist revolutionaries and radicals, you know, if only, right? I mean, trust me, that ain't happening. But and so therefore, you know, it's they feel uncomfortable about having these, you know, expressing their views and the like. I will tell you, after 20 years of teaching at Ohio State, you know, it ain't the political conservatives who feel uncomfortable sort of sharing their thoughts and ideas in the classroom. That, you know, academia has always historically been a place for conservative ideas, right? Look at we get the Supreme Court justices and all these coming from Yale and all this other stuff, right? You know, trust me, they weren't uncomfortable sharing those ideas. So I think when we talk about comfort and discomfort, we have to be specific about the subject and alike. But, you know, in general, the classroom should be a place where you feel uncomfortable, right? Where you're learning new ideas and you're trying to figure these things out. There's a difference between being uncomfortable and unsafe. We don't move, you know, talking about these difficult subjects won't make you unsafe, as though some people are saying. No, it's not unsafe. Uncomfortable, yeah, but you lean into that discomfort. That's where your ideas get challenged and strengthened, and you move and you change. That's how you open up your mind. That's what we should be doing. And teaching students how to work through discomfort in the classroom around these difficult subjects, rather than pretending as though they just simply don't exist or we should stay away from them.
Another measure pending in the Ohio House would establish new social studies standards based on the conservative American birthright civic standards from Civics Alliance. And that specifically goes, and they say that they take some of their, whatever they're teaching from the 1776 commission,
which is connected to Hillsdale College out of Michigan,
Southern Michigan. Yeah.
And it's ahistoric. It's history that didn't happen. Right. It's blending, you know, sort of religion and civics in a way that really worries me in terms of the framing of the founders, you know, sort of almost as though the people who started this nation, you know, were divinely inspired and all this other stuff. It's like, come on, right? Because if you're able to frame, and this is what scares me about that particular approach of, you know, that you can't criticize, you can't critique the framers and the founders and essentially anybody else who comes down the line as a patriot or whatnot, because then there's no room for growth. There's no room for reinterpretation. That worries me.
I think it's an interesting proposition to say that you can't criticize them when if you read anything like, you know, Miracle in Philadelphia or any book about the creation of the Constitution and how they wrote it, all they did was criticize each other.
We are doing nothing more than they did themselves.
Yes, to each other.
And James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, they're saying that they're actually rejecting that idea. They're recognizing their own fallibility. And now they don't always address the issues that they are most fallible on, such as owning people and buying and selling people, right? I mean, they kick that can down the road.
Yep.
So when I teach, you know, about the founders, and you want to talk about 1776 and everything that comes around there, it's not that I don't want my students to, you know, be like the founders. Well, in fact, I don't. I want them to be better than them. You can be better than the person who was buying and selling people, even if they wrote the Declaration of Independence.
And didn't they even write and the documents that we have that we look to and hold so, you know, on such put on such pedestals, that they were written in a way that they wanted us to be better too?
Of course. A more perfect union.
Yeah.
Right?
In
striving
order
to be better. In order to, right? We weren't there. So improve upon it. But that gets into sort of the politics of, you know, sort of, you know, original interpretations, right? Because if you have to go back and you're going to uphold that particular view that what they wrote down and what they said was sacrosanct, then there's not a lot of room for actually improving on what they put down on paper.
It's like the Bible.
It is. And it shouldn't be, right? That
we know for sure that humans wrote the Declaration.
We do, exactly, right?
Nothing divine about
so,
it.
So, you know, one of the developments of the political developments of the moment that we live in that really concerns me is that, and particularly stemming from the political right, is that the politics on the political right has increasingly become like religion. In that, you know, when we think about the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and we think about what's at the core of those religions is faith. But faith is belief in the absence of fact. Belief, you believe it despite what I may or some scientist or somebody else presents. That's the essence of faith. You don't need to see anything else. You believe it. But our politics on the political right is like, no, I just believe this. In the absence of, I believe what Donald Trump says in the absence of fact. I believe what QAnon says in the absence of fact. We can't work with that, right? Because this is not religion. We have to agree. We can disagree on interpretation, on meaning, on impact, but we can't disagree on the existence of certain things. That to me is really worrisome because how do you move forward? You can't.
You know, one aspect of all of this, they talk about policies versus discipline. So let's take climate science. Mm. And, well, climate science is a given thing. Let's say climate change. Mm-hmm. Climate change is an accepted issue now. But you can't talk about policies to address climate change. And I don't understand the logic of that disconnect and where they're headed. What do you think?
I mean, I think that's a perfect example of this idea of politics becoming like religion. If you just absolutely believe that that climate change isn't occurring, isn't being impacted by human behavior, rejecting the science that says, look, this is real, then you can't have a policy discussion because you refuse to acknowledge the existence of a reality. That, I think, is deeply troubling. And I don't know where to go with that.
Right. I mean, they're saying, like, the legislators that support this would say, well, no, we accept climate change. It's a thing. But we can't talk about the policies to address it. That is what would make people uncomfortable. And,
you know, we're actually doing one of the programs that I have a hand in here at Ohio State through the Global Arts and Humanities Discovery theme, where we bring in teachers from Central Ohio to talk about difficult subjects. And we have one cohort who has been meeting all semester long working on American slavery, and another cohort working on climate justice and how to teach and talk about it in the classroom for kids from K through 12. so that hopefully while we as adults may get to this point where we're like, we don't know how to talk about the policy issues, the kids coming up will be taught and instructed about how to deal with these issues and do better than us.
You know, I thought that would be the case. Years ago, 30 years ago, I wrote a column about how all these kids going to these fancy, beautiful schools with their fancy science classes and laboratories and everything, they had the best of everything, that there would be a reckoning would come, that the kids would outflank their parents on issues. They would understand better than their parents. But I'm wondering now, given this backlash.
Well, we saw that. In 2020, the summer of 2020, I mean, the George Floyd protests,
yeah.
Millions of people, mostly young people, taken to the streets demanding an end to systemic racism. That was the buildup. And what we're getting now is a response, a backlash to that.
My guest is Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's an associate professor of history at Ohio State. He teaches courses on the civil rights movement and Black Power movement. He's also the host of the Teaching Hard History podcast. And that's what we're talking about today, is how to teach hard history. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them alive was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to the Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Support for WBOSU comes from the Compost Exchange, offering curbside composting pilot programs in the spring to Columbus area single-family residents living in small and large neighborhoods, HOAs, condo communities, and entire cities. Program details at thecompostexchange.com/citywidepilot.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. After the U.S. Supreme Court decision Brown v. the Board of Education in 1954, the nation tried to desegregate. But the more things change, the more they stay the same. Reports from the Government Accountability Office and the University of Southern California reveal that most schools overwhelmingly serve one race with minimal exposure to students of other races. Still with me is Ohio State historian Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He teaches courses on the civil rights and Black Power movements, and he is the host of the Teaching Hard History podcast. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. All right, the population of non-white students in the U.S. is increasing across the board, but the number of schools primarily serving students of a single race is still very high. This isn't state mandated. Nobody's ordering people to live like this. Why do you think what do you think about this modern form of segregation? Because the bottom line is we're learning separately.
We are learning separately. And it's unfortunate because we live in these separate worlds. And so schools, the reality is that schools are the place where people of different backgrounds, different races, ethnicities, religions will come together. And if we can persist in maintaining segregated schools, then we will never have that opportunity for our children to learn from one another sitting next to each other. And, you know, we can, you know, a lot of it has to do with public policy, with the new attempts for vouchers and the like. But also, you know, segregated schools, especially post-Brown or post-1965, mm-hmm. you know, have really reflected our housing choices, our residential patterns. And we're still choosing to live in segregated communities. White folk are still choosing to live in Upper Arlington and Grandview, which is, you know, 90% plus white. And it's not an accident. And until we decide as a community broadly defined that, you know what, it's okay to live with one another. It's okay to share resources. It's okay to drop these artificial boundaries for school districts that we've created. You can erase them with a pen. They're not etched in marble or stone. Then we will continue to segregate and resegregate as we've done since the late 70s, early 1980s.
Let's see. Let's turn to Eric in Dublin. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I think the professor is totally off base because I don't think he understands what America really is, what the Constitution's about. The statement that Barack Obama once had, well, we're not really, this isn't an exceptional country. Yes, it is. We're the first multicultural country to exist, and things were going very well for a long period of time. Blacks were increasing in their employment rates, their income scheduling. Everything else seemed to be floating along, and all of a sudden, we're telling blacks in the way they're treated, particularly through abortion, I think, at this point. Blacks are more affected by things like abortion. And when I look at the school system of the city of Columbus as a prime example, there are 900 systems within the state of Ohio. Out of that 900, Columbus ranks 747. And who's running the entire operation now and who's been running education for a long time is the Democrat Party. And we're seeing the results of it right now. Test scores are long, and this whole idea of DEI, I call it basically division, exclusion equals insanity, because you're excluding people, blacks as well as whites, from basically achieving and having goals to achieve for. Well, and this whole idea of victimization that goes along with it, I think it's totally wrong. Well, so I think you need to reevaluate your own interests and your own goals as far as a professor are concerned, and reexamine everything that you're looking at right now.
Eric, thanks for that call. Hassan Kwame Jeffries, that's a lot to unpack. pick your spot.
It is a lot to unpack, and I appreciate Eric for the for reminding me to constantly be reflective on my experiences and my studies of the American journey. And I assure him that I do that all the time. And as a result of that constant reflection, I have come to the exact opposite conclusion and which apparently troubles Eric greatly. This notion of just the last point that he made of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and bringing diverse voices and highlighting the diversity of experience somehow excludes other people. And by other people, essentially he's talking about white people and more than likely white Christian, white men. It's like, trust me, y'all ain't going nowhere. Nobody's trying to remove you from the table. Adding seats to the table does not mean that others have to be rejected. And it's playing to this notion of sort of fear and disruption and chaos, which has never been the goal. African Americans, you know, have always been at the forefront of the effort to expand democracy, even when they were not the beneficiaries of it. And so that struggle continues. And I think one last thing, we also have to be clear that, you know, we are burdened by this myth of perpetual racial progress, that somehow things may have been bad in the past, but by golly, this is America and things always get better. All you have to do is let time move forward and things will improve. Well, that's not the reality. If we look at the statistics of employment, you know, you want to talk about numbers and housing and wealth, those gaps have been increasing between white folk and black folk, especially over the last quarter century. So things have not gotten better. Poverty rates have not gotten better in ways that they should have. And so the question isn't just merely, well, just let things transpire, let the hands of time continue to tick away without action. No, I say we have to take action because the problems still persist.
Eric, thanks again for that call, 614-292-8513. If you have something you want to add, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's an associate professor of history at Ohio State. He teaches courses on the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement. He's also hosted the Teaching Hard History podcast. We'll have a link to that at our website at WOSU.org. Let's see. There's some really great calls I want to take. Michael in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hello. Hi. This is my first time talking to you. I appreciate your program. And I'm sad this is basically you moving on and going on retirement. So I'm a little bit sad.
Thank you.
Thanks for everything that you've done. Professor Kwame, thank you for what you do. My name is Michael Osei Morgan, and I took history in Columbus State. It was an eye opener coming into the country, and it was just beautiful and sad and very hard to just take everything in. But I think it's an eye opener, and we see the government trying to take that away. I don't think it's a good idea. No matter how hard it is, history is history. We have to know what our background was, how the founding fathers did everything, started slavery and everything. As hard as it is, I don't think that it's something that needs to be scraped, but actually has to keep going in schools so that, you know, generation upon generation will get to know how everything transpired. Yeah. That's my little contribution.
Michael, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And thank you for listening. You know, there's something he said in there. He said it was beautiful and it was sad.
You know, that's the American story, right? And you know, James Baldwin, you know, famously said, when in doubt, turn to James Baldwin, right?
Yeah.
He said, we are our history. We are our history. Not we are the beautiful stuff and not we are just the hard and bad stuff. We are collectively all of it. And you can't really appreciate the beauty unless you fully understand and see the ugly, because they coexist. One informs the other. And so he's absolutely right. There is great beauty in the American journey, but there's also great sadness and tragedy. And just focusing on one and not the other, whether it's the good or the bad, doesn't do anyone any benefit.
You can't appreciate the better part of us if we don't understand the worst part of us.
Absolutely. And prevent us from doing those things again.
Right.
And continuing them, right, as we have in so many areas.
Terry in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Ann, and thank you for all the wonderful shows you've hosted. It's really been amazing. Thank you also, Professor Jeffries. I've heard you before, and I've really been interested in what you've said. I wanted to bring up Frederick Douglass and a very specific thing about Frederick Douglass. I recently went through his autobiography by audiobook, which was especially a treat. And the part at the end where he is giving a speech, it's a record of his speech at the dedication of the famous statue of Abraham Lincoln east of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that speech has ever been used as a teaching moment in history classes, either at OSU or elsewhere.
Well, certainly. I have a number of colleagues who have referenced that speech in talking about sort of the Black experience, not only during slavery, but the emancipation and post-emancipation era. It's especially relevant, I think, for those who, if you get a chance to Google not just the speech, but the statue that he's talking about, especially coming in the wake of this moment of young people saying, listen, we need to reevaluate our monuments and memorials in public spaces, because it's a wonderful statue of Abraham Lincoln, but it has a formerly enslaved person sort of kneeling at his feet. Mm. And it's sort of, you know, sort of the great white man, you know, sort of, you know,
savior,
right? You know, Father Abraham, right, if you will. And Frederick Douglass is like, you know what, this ain't the best representation in the world. However, it doesn't take away from the significant role that Abraham Lincoln played. But we know that black folk and Lincoln, Douglas himself saying, you know, I was, you know, had to push Lincoln, you know, to allow African-Americans to fight for the Union Army in their own freedom. So this isn't the best representation of the role that we played in our struggle for freedom, but it sure is a whole lot better to be included than to be excluded. Mm-hmm. So we can do better in the future, right? But for right now, this is what we got, and we're going to go with it.
Terry, thank you so much for that call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You mentioned earlier policies like school choice. And in the latest proposal in the pending state budget, at 450% of the federal poverty level, a family of four making $165,000 or less in 2023, or most Ohioans, would be eligible for the expanded Ed Choice Scholarship Program. Eligibility is determined either through financial eligibility or school building eligibility if the school is considered low performing. They're taking this all the way right to the brink now.
They are. And I think in any conversations that we have about public education and school choice, I think we have to put it into the broader historical context of where this desire to have public funding for private education, this idea of choice in some way, shape, or form actually comes from. You know, we mentioned, you mentioned the Brown decision, 1954. Well, it took 10 years from 1954 to 1965 for there to be any significant movement in desegregation of public schools. And it only occurs, it only begins starting in 1965 when Johnson signs the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, making billions of dollars available to public schools, but they had to desegregate. You could no longer have a dual education system that was public. But ever since that moment, the response at the time of white segregationists in the South was, well, we're going to leave public schools and we're going to create private segregationist academies. And they begin to do so throughout the South. By the 1970s, those private segregationist academies that are proudly saying that we are all white, they rebrand. They rebrand as Christian academies. Mm. This is in the mid-1970s. Mm. And throughout that period, that first 10-year period, and ever since, there's been this effort from those segregationist academies to those Christian academies to get public funding for those private schools. And when we take that in the context, and from there, we go to vouchers, we go to school choice. So this is part of a longer history. Not saying there aren't some problems with public education. To be sure, we mm-hmm. could be doing a lot better. We could be spending more. But essentially, what these programs have wound up doing is siphoning money out of public education and into this, whether it's choice or vouchers and all these other things. There's wonderful programs that can be done to supplement public education. But the reality is, especially for black and brown children, that the majority, the overwhelming majority, will always be educated in public schools where they are. So we should be doing more to support and invest rather than to pull out and separate.
We're going to take a break. My guest is Hassan Kwame Jeffries, a historian at Ohio State. He teaches courses on the Civil Rights Movement and Black Power Movement. And I encourage you to check out his podcast, Teaching Hard History Podcast. We'll have a link to that at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll take some calls and we'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, we're talking about American history today with Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's an associate professor of history at OSU, where he teaches courses on the Civil Rights Movement and Black Power Movement. He's also host of the Teaching Hard History podcast. Got a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I think it's interesting that those American birthrights standards that they're talking about replacing civics courses in middle school in Ohio, they would de-emphasize the history of slavery and the treatment of American Indians. I mean, now they're rolling it all into one.
Right, right. I mean, which is the starting point, right? Like, I mean, they're not even pretending as though the effort isn't to erase, right? They're not going to pretend that those slavery didn't happen. We're just not going to talk about it, right? We're not going to, you know, we're going to ignore, you know, the reality of the genocide against Native Americans. For what point? I mean, in other words, no child in any classroom is being blamed for the institution of slavery or the genocide against Native peoples, right? No child is being blamed for Jim Crow or mass incarceration or all the foolishness that we have going on today. They're not responsible for it, and nobody is saying that they are. So why are we afraid to educate our children about history that actually happened? The reality, though, is that our children in the classrooms today are absolutely responsible for tomorrow. And it's our duty as educators to prepare them for tomorrow, to provide them with the tools and understanding that they'll need to address the problems that we haven't been able to solve today. And we cannot do that if we are engaged in educational malpractice. And that is exactly what we do when we pretend as though the hard stuff never happened.
Julie in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Hi, Julie.
Hi. First, I wanted to hope that you have a long, healthy, and happy retirement.
Thanks, Julie. I appreciate that.
My parents taught us probably what you would call uncomfortable history. Because when we went to Monticello or the like, my mom talked about the slavery and how it wouldn't be there without slaves. And the westward expansion and pushing the Indians aside. But one thing that we found interesting, she read the autobiography of Malcolm X and realized she went to school with him. In fact, they were in the same class. And we discussed it. She said, you know, she was a white girl and he was a black young man. She says, both of our stories could be true, even though they don't match. And she said, that's important to understand.
Oops, sorry, Julie. I just deleted you. Sorry about that. But Julie doesn't sound like, you know, sounds like she's been around the block a few times. So,
And kudos to Julie's mom, right? Raising her in a way that, you know, did not hide the uncomfortable truths. A fascinating, amazing intersection with a historical figure in terms of Malcolm X. But, you know, Julie's mom did it right. Right. And guess what? Julie is still standing. Right. She ain't Fidel Castro. Right. She sounds like she appreciates the American journey. And that's all we're saying. It doesn't corrupt the mind to study historical truth and reality.
I remember my dad took me on a business trip with him one time to, of all places, Akron. Well, not Akron exactly, but we made a side trip to Kent State University. Mm. It was after the shooting. And the Kent State killings, and he was a Republican, you know, thing, but he just thought it was, and I think it was in the fifth, sixth grade at the time. I was not old. I wasn't particularly that young, but I was still tender. And he told me about what happened there. And we just stood there.
And, you know, one of the things that those types of experiences does for children is it gets them to ask questions and to search for answers so that a tragedy like that doesn't happen again. That's it. That's the most radical thing that will come out of sharing that kind of story and history from whether it's a parent or an educator. that something like that doesn't happen again. I think that's good parenting, and that's also good teaching.
Let's see. Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ann. Professor Jeffries, thank you for your columns I've read in the local newspaper. I wanted to comment on the whole charter school thing. I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s, attended parochial grade school and high school. My parents were always really clear about, we don't need government support. We have chosen to opt out of the public school system that we're paying property taxes to fund. We'll absorb the extra cost to provide a parochial school education that includes religion as part of our choice. This whole charter school movement, as Professor Jeffries pointed out, is really just an attempt to sidestep that. And as to the first caller who called in, if Dublin and Arlington and Grandview and other surrounding districts would merge with the Columbus system, we might see more equitable funding and more concern right across the board for students of all backgrounds.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point. I mean, how we fund our schools impacts the quality of education that our children receive. And we know that our funding model is grossly inequitable. It's been no secret. It's tied to property taxes. Obviously, if you're living in a more wealthier neighborhood, then there are greater resources for your schools. The state Supreme Court has already said repeatedly that that funding model is unconstitutional, but we haven't broken away from it. We have to do better. And then finally, the point on parochial schools. You're absolutely right. You know, you have the choice to opt out of public education. This is not a theocracy. But then you have a choice to opt in. And if you choose to opt in, you can't impose your particular religious beliefs and values on the education that we receive.
Right now we have a call from Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
Surprise, surprise.
Did you know this?
Who knew? Who knew? Who knew? What's
Welcome
up, Hakeem?
Welcome to the show.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. I was introduced as the minority leader, but I'm really better known as Hassan's older brother.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's great to be on. I just really want to congratulate you on just a tremendous run in anchoring this show, providing news and insight and information to the people of Columbus and beyond in such an extraordinary way. You know, the foundation of our democracy, of course, is anchored in the three branches of government, the legislative branch, the executive branch, and, of course, the judiciary. But closely connected to those three branches of government is what has affectionately been referred to, of course, as the fourth estate, the media, and the ability to hold people who are in power accountable, to inform the electorate, to make sure that people have visibility into the issues that they're confronting in their day-to-day lives. And Ann, you've done that in such an extraordinary way. Congratulations on an extraordinary career.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. How much did he pay you? No, we've had a lot of fun talking about you over the last couple of years. So I'm honored. Thank you so much for calling in today. I'm absolutely floored and honored and really appreciate it and look forward to following your career going forward in my leisure.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, I'm proud, of course, of my younger brother. And I know he's had a close relationship with the show throughout the years. And I appreciate you indulging him throughout the years, and I know he's enjoyed participating. You've got a great audience, you know, who you've really served and benefited in a wonderful way. And, you know, just an honor for me to be able to call in and wish you all the best in the next chapter of your journey.
Thank you. That is Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of the U.S. House of Representatives, the older brother of my guest, Hassan Kwame Jeffries. Thank you so much, Leader Jeffries. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. All the best.
Thanks,
Hakeem. Love you, man.
Well.
I said we had to get him on at some point, right?
Well, I mean, yeah. You're making all my dreams come true. So I usually reserve that for my spouse. You know, you are at an interesting kind of probably emotional intersection, being the younger brother of seeing history being made in that way and being, you know, more than closer than 6 degrees of separation. You're an interesting dovetail, the two of you.
Yeah. You know, sometimes to connect to the conversation that we've had this morning, and talking about, we had to call and say, "Oh, you're talking about victimization. You know, black people being victimized."
That's another thing. Yeah.
And you know, they're like, "You don't believe that there's been any progress?" I was like, "That's ridiculous. Of course, there's been progress. My brother is the minority leader in the U.S. Congress. That was." Inconceivable as we were growing up as kids in Brooklyn. So of course there's been progress. The point is, there could have been more. There should have been more. We should be further along. We could be and should be in a better place. And if we don't protect the gains that we have made, then we will lose them. Roe v. Wade. And so it's a constant struggle. It's a constant fight. But in order to understand how far we have come, but also how far we have to go, we really have to dig deep and make sure that we're teaching honestly about the past and the present.
You know, I'm doing a show tomorrow about civics. Mm. We talk a lot about this issue one that's going to be on the ballot in a special election in August, which is traditionally, historically, the lowest turnout election time, which is why the Republicans in the Ohio General Assembly abolished it last year and then changed their minds for this issue to come up on whether or not voters should make it harder for themselves to amend the state constitution.
Right.
And I'm just really curious about your thoughts about democracy. You made me think about that just extemporaneously when you were talking about we have to exercise this privilege we have, this democratic privilege, or we could lose it.
No, absolutely. I mean, democracy and this democracy is not guaranteed. It is fragile. It is a government of the people, for the people, and supposedly by the people. And it doesn't matter which side of the political spectrum that you fall on. You should always want to make democracy more accessible to the people. That means more accessible to people to participate, whether it's voting or through these constitutional ballot. We shouldn't be making it harder. And again, we may disagree on policy issues, but we shouldn't disagree on the importance of protecting democracy and making it accessible to people. So I'm gravely concerned about this movement to make it harder. For people to participate in
that
way.
It's not like the tendency to contract voter access hasn't been tried before.
Right. I mean, look, we have, you know, all these voter IDs.
Again, history.
History, right? It tells us, right? Yeah. Now, we have a longer history of voter exclusion than we have voter inclusion. History tells us that contemporary moments tells us we don't have a voter impersonation problem. In fact, most Americans don't even vote. Right. I mean, so nobody's running around, some, you know, three or four Republicans in North Carolina voting 2 and 3 times. But most people don't vote. So we're creating solutions in search of problems. We don't have a democracy. The only problem with our democracy right now is that it's not open enough. We don't have enough access to it. We shouldn't be doing things to constrict it. We should be doing things to expand it.
And people feel overwhelmed, the issues. I mean, I know as a journalist, and I've been covering most of these same issues for 40 years, it's coming at us fast and furious, and they're overwhelmed. I hear some people feel like, you know, say, I just assume somebody picked things for me. I don't have the time anymore.
Well, that's not an accident. I mean, that's part of, I think, a concerted effort create so much noise that these measures that will have lasting impact, not just for a couple of election cycles, but potentially for generations, slip through. Because if people were able to focus on one or two of these issues at the same time, they'd be like, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense, right? Why are we doing this? But if there's 15 of them, right, then it's like, you know, if it's not, I don't feel the direct impact, then, you know, oh, well, I'm worried about paying bills.
What's it like in your classes these days? Are they mostly black students in your classes, or how do you describe the racial, the socioeconomic makeup?
Oh, Lord, it's Ohio State. So almost all my students are white.
Right.
I mean, we got to be, you know, if I had if I have 20% of my students in the courses on African-American history or civil rights movement who are students of color, then I'm doing something. So the vast majority of my students are white, and most of them, I think middle class to working class, but they're working. The majority mm-hmm. of my students are also working. And, and I think this is also part of the concern that's coming from the political right. My students are not just engaging in this history and accepting it for the truth that I'm presenting, but they're doing more than that. They're taking and accepting that history, and then they're wanting to do something about it, right? They're not just settling on acceptance and learning. They want action. So more and more of my students are saying, look, we got to do something about these persistent problems. And to me, that's exciting. But to others who want to preserve the status quo because they benefit from it, even though it harms others, that's frightening. And I think that's what we're feeling right now.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, it's absolutely been a privilege over the years to talk with you. I feel like it's just been such a luxury to have you here right in our backyard at Ohio State. Thank you so much for your help understanding these issues over the years. I know you'll continue. You're not going away, so thank you for that.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you for all the years and for just such a great conversation. You truly have been a light.
That's Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at OSU. He teaches courses on the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement, and he's also host of the Teaching Hard History podcast. We'll have a link to that at our website at wosu.org/allsides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.